The 1980 baseball season was nearing its end, and Rick Honeycutt was getting desperate. He'd made the All-Star team in July, but since then, nothing had gone his way. He'd tried everything, except cheating.
I was a kid that didn't have even a taste of alcohol until I went to college. Southern Baptist, you know.
It was a hot September day in Kansas City, and Honeycutt was taking the mound for the Seattle Mariners. He knew that pitchers had been messing with the ball for years, smearing it with pine tar or hair gel, scuffing it with sandpaper or a buckle, to make the ball move in ways batters wouldn't expect. This was all very much against the rules, but other guys had gotten away with it. Why shouldn't he?
So I'm walking out to warm up, and I pass the bulletin board, and there's a thumbtack on the bulletin board. I'm like, man, that would scuff up a baseball.
So Honeycutt decided to tape that tack to his right index finger and hide it inside his glove.
After I warmed up, I come back in the dugout. It's still humid and you're sweating in Kansas City, and I grab a towel, take my hat off, wear my forehead, and I just scratch myself right across my forehead. Right then, I should have just said, this isn't working.
But sanity did not prevail. Honeycutt kept the tack taped to his finger and hidden in his glove. He tossed the first inning without using it, then the second. He had a shutout going into the third. But then, with two outs, he got greedy. Royals outfielder Willie Wilson came to bat, and that's when Honeycutt took his right hand out of his glove and scratched.
I throw it and hits a ball, this kind of looper down the right field line.
A hit. He was pissed. This was supposed to make him pitch better, not worse. It didn't occur to him that maybe the reason he'd never heard another pitcher talk about using a thumbtack was that thumbtacks don't really work. Then George Brett stepped to the plate.
And I get the ball back, try to whack it up some more, and he gets a base hit, and Willie Wilson scores.
Yeah, this was not going how Honeycutt envisioned. And he was too busy being annoyed to notice Wilson had approached an umpire and started to talk.
And the home plate umpire is a gentleman named Bill Kunkel. And Bill used to be a big league pitcher. All of a sudden, I kind of glance back, and I see Kunkel now coming towards the mound. And I'm like, panic attack.
The umpire was on to him.
I turn towards the outfield, take my glove off, but I'm trying to get it off my finger.
He starts shaking his hand, pulling at the tape.
And I can't get it off, so I put my glove back on, and then I turn back around, and there's Bill. And he goes, I need to see your hand. So I show him my left hand, and he goes, no, the other hand.
He holds out his right hand, palm down, to hide the tack.
And he grabs my hand and grabs the tack.
He'd stabbed the umpire.
And he goes, you're out of here. And I'm like, Bill, you're a pitcher. I said, it didn't even work. He's like, I don't care. You're out of here.
His argument against getting tossed was that he hadn't cheated well enough to be disciplined. It fell on deaf ears.
All of a sudden, you're thinking the worst thing. You're thinking like, God, can I get kicked out of baseball? Have I ruined my career?
Honeycutt was only the second player ever ejected for ball doctoring. And he was the first in nearly 40 years. Being caught felt like a violation of baseball's gentleman's agreement to treat the rulebook like a suggestion. You see, cheating is integral to America's pastime. But baseball isn't alone. Athletes across all sports bend the rules to their advantage. So does everyone, you and me. In this episode, I'm going to do something a little bit different and venture beyond sports to explore cheating more generally as part of human nature. I'll also ask if by tolerating cheating, baseball helped accelerate it. From ball doctoring all the way to anabolic steroids. I'm Joan Neeson, and this is Crushed. There is nothing new about cheating in sports. It's been going on for thousands of years. In fact, legend has it that the very first Olympic Games in ancient Greece would never have happened if it weren't for a little bit of sabotage. You see, the games were held as a celebration after a man named Pelops married a princess. But Pelops was only able to marry this princess because he beat her father in a chariot race. And he only won that race because he bribed someone to tamper with the king's chariot. In other words, he cheated to get the girl and then threw the Olympics as a party to celebrate. So, not exactly fair play. And in modern times, not much has changed.
Bill Belichick had an assistant videotape signals or play calls.
Cincinnati Reds manager Pete Rose bet on not only the game of baseball, but on the Reds as
well. Lance Armstrong is considered one of the greatest athletes of all time, but he's also the focus of a federal investigation into performance-enhancing drugs.
The controversy has already called into question the legitimacy of the Houston Astros' 2017 World Series title.
And it's not just famous athletes who cheat, or Olympians. So do little leaguers and unknown runners. Which brings us to my favorite cheating story, Rosie Ruiz's Boston Marathon victory that wasn't.
Ruiz was an unknown with little technical knowledge of long distance running. The fact that she won and was never seen by race officials or in videotapes of the marathon until the final stretch has sparked the biggest controversy in the history of the prestigious event.
Turns out, Ruiz rode the subway for part of the race and jumped back onto the course about a half a mile before the finish line. She won with an unbelievable time, but soon she was found out. For years, though, she insisted she'd run the entire race.
No, there's no doubt in my mind. I know what I did, and I will prove it again in the future.
I'm in awe of her insistence, despite so much evidence to the contrary, that she did everything above board. And that got me thinking. How do people look at themselves in the mirror after they blatantly cheat? Or how do they ignore what they've just done? I'll admit, I'm an extremely type A rule follower, and I've never thought of myself as a cheater until I called Mike Norton. He's a Harvard business professor who studies bias, self-delusion, and cheating.
If we do something good, it's very easy for us to incorporate it into our view of ourselves. Maybe too easy. And when we do bad things, for some reason, it's very hard for us to bring that into our view of ourself as a whole. Think of a crossword. It's like, you know, seven down. And I don't know the answer, but I kind of think I could know the answer. So I flip to the answers and then I see that the answer is Dubuque. And I know that I flip to the answers to see that. But as I'm flipping back to fill it in, I kind of say to myself, well, I would have gotten that right anyway. And then later on, I say, yeah, I totally got Dubuque right.
I am a huge crossword puzzle doer, and I started doing the crossword every Sunday. Then I bought a book because I was like, I want to get better, and I'm getting better at them. So I put little stars where I cheat.
Oh,
basically,
nice.
Whenever I look up an answer, I put a star, but I found myself doing exactly what you just described, where I'm like, oh, I thought it was kind of that. I was just checking myself, and I'm not.
Yeah, and you say things like, the answer turns out to be Wednesday, and you were thinking Monday. But, you know, it's basically, so I got it right.
So this is how we create myths about ourselves, our skills, our genius. We think we're actually as good as we are when we cheat. And so does everyone else. My conversation with Norton made me wonder, how does this apply to baseball? To McGuire, even? This is a guy who was told from his rookie year on that he had a chance to break the home run record. He'd been told he was that good.
If you were to construct a home run hitter in a lab, put them together, he'd look like that.
But then, in the early 90s, McGuire got hurt over and over and missed the bulk of two full seasons. He says that's when he started taking steroids, right when his performance fell off. He cheated, and then he was back to playing like the star he'd been, the star everyone expected him to be. So I can see how stopping might have felt impossible, how cheating might have felt like the only way to actually be the player he believed he was. I'd love to ask him all of this, and I have tried, but so far he hasn't responded. So I don't know what McGuire was thinking, but there's a lot we do know about the cheater's mind. Norton told me about this experiment he and a few other researchers ran. They gave some people an intelligence test, and they gave others the same test, but with an answer key at the bottom. They were told they could use it to check themselves, if they wanted. So of course the people with the key used it. It's human nature. And they perform better than those without it. But things got interesting when Norton gave those people a new test without answers and asked them to predict how they'd do.
So they should say, last time I looked at the answers, so this time I should maybe think I'm not going to do as well because I don't have the answers. Not at all. People now think that that's how good they are.
Do you think that incentivizes people to try to cheat in the future then because their expectations are inflated of themselves and they've got to do anything to kind of get to the point of their inflated expectations?
For sure. Now that I think I'm that level of good, then cheating a little bit is okay because it's only actually getting me up to how good I am. I'm not cheating because I'm not getting better than I am. That is like cheating. All the cheating is doing is helping me bump up to my fake level. So it's still cheating. It just doesn't feel like cheating.
And from there, cheating becomes a domino effect. One person starts, then continues to cheat because it makes him feel like he's reaching the level of success he deserves. Then other people notice he's cheating and they start cheating too. And before you know it, everybody's cheating.
Something that's really troubling, and you see this a lot with people who are cheating, is it's almost unfair if you don't cheat because everyone else is cheating and getting ahead. And so if I don't cheat, I'm an idiot.
Now apply that to sports, where journalists like me critique players' every move, where kids put on their favorite players' jerseys and dream of following in their footsteps. It's no wonder that athletes cheat and feel powerless to stop. They're trapped. I'm thinking of Maguire again here, and the child-sized jersey I once owned, and the pressures that come with having your name on someone else's back. When we left Rick Honeycutt, he was wondering if a thumbtack had derailed his career. He was in total shock, and who could blame him? Other pitchers used pine tar, jellies, rosin, mud, all the time. Hitters made subtle and sometimes not so subtle tweaks to their bats, too. And if one person was doing it, then anyone could. And everyone had a right to be as good as that extra help could make him. This is Mike Norton's research at work. It's crossword puzzle hints, an answer key for sports. Here's Honeycutt again.
I got suspended for 10 days and got fined, so.
And then I'm guessing you didn't do anything in the future either after that. This scared you straight?
Well, definitely not with the tack. I still experimented with things, but not the thumbtack was definitely not the way to go.
What were your later experiments? I'm curious. Did that even work?
The later experiments, actually, there was some success with KY jelly and sweat.
Oh, interesting.
A little dab of do ya.
Wait, what? Honeycutt was mortified after the tack incident, but then he kept doctoring balls? Getting caught just made him switch to a more conventional method. You see, baseball has a long history of condoning, let's call it acceptable cheating. Gaylord Perry, who was a super talented starting pitcher in the 60s and 70s, admitted in the middle of his career that he tossed an illegal spitball. And he was still inducted into the Hall of Fame. So was Whitey Ford, a Yankees ace notorious for tampering with baseballs. Sometimes he'd use his wedding ring to slice the leather, or he'd have his catcher use the buckle on his shin guard. And it's said that he concocted a special mix of baby oil, turpentine, and rosin that he kept in a roll-on container, which Yogi Berra mistook for deodorant. Yogi borrowed it, and he glued his arms to his sides. That's maybe even funnier than Honeycutt's thumbtack. And yeah, it's cheating. But it's also just part of the game, part of its history. And that might be the most compelling argument for cheating in baseball. It's a tradition.
Really, it's learning from the older guys. It's trial and error. And honestly, as a pure baseball guy, that is what's so cool about sports in baseball.
That's Mike Trombley. He pitched in the 90s and early 2000s for the Twins, Orioles, and Dodgers. And over the years, he developed some tricks. When he debuted, the Twins played in the Metrodome, which was climate controlled.
Well, it was 70 degrees every day, and I knew that if I mixed a little bit of shaving cream with some pine tar and some rosin, that worked, and so I knew what my grip on that ball was going to be like every day.
But not everywhere had a roof. In Detroit one April, Trombley learned he needed a more creative concoction to get control of an icy ball.
I had to pour hot coffee on my leg to try to get some moisture on the ball, so a little bit of pine tar and a little bit of hot coffee. Think about it. Detroit, it's 30 degrees out. And if I don't use something, the ball's going to go to the backstop because the ball's frozen, my hand's frozen. when I would pitch in Baltimore and it was hot and humid, I had to come up with a new way of, I needed a little more rosin. You know, I got a lot of hair on my arm, so I put the rosin and it would cake on there. That was perfect. Perfect for me.
Trombley never got in trouble. If anyone noticed, it was understood they'd look the other way. Because this wasn't some elaborate scheme to throw pitches that defied gravity or make a mockery of the sport. It was just a guy with cold hands, or sweaty ones, trying to get a grip on a fickle ball.
Now, is that cheating? Are they going to look at me and say, Mike, you're not getting in a Hall of Fame because you did that? I mean, come on. You know, it's a game. I think that part of the game makes it so special. And I wish the fans would appreciate that more instead of going, oh my God, he broke a rule. This stinks. Come on. It's such a fun thing. And if they would take it for what that is, I think they'd enjoy it more.
I see his point. All of this scheming does sound like fun. And like it probably couldn't turn a mediocre arm into a Cy Young winner. And it's not like it's just pitchers who pull these stunts. Hitters are also notorious for trying all kinds of tricks to enhance their bats.
Corked bats, they are not taught in the Boy Scout manual, but they're part of the national pastime. Now, you get a lighter bat, you then get more bat speed, and when players are caught, you get explanations that sound like a grown-up version of the dog ate my homework.
In 1994, Cleveland slugger Albert Bell was suspended after umpires caught him using a corked bat. And here's how his manager reacted.
This has been going on for 100 years. It's been going on before I played and after I played, obviously. And, you know, it's kind of a gentleman's agreement, more at least I thought it was, unless the guy's really blatant with it, then nothing's really done about it.
He complained that baseball had what? Acted out of turn for enforcing a rule? I can't believe he said that, much less said it on the news. But people around baseball were used to protesting when punished. Sometimes it even worked. Remember George Brett, the batter who got a hit right before Rick Honeycutt and his weaponized finger were found out? Well, you might have figured out by now that almost no one in our story is totally innocent.
George Brett has just homered, and Billy Martin and the Yankees want the bat.
Well, what they're talking about, Frank, is that he's got too much pine tar, and you've got to have a certain amount of distance from the trademark of the bat and the pine tar. I'm not sure. They might have a legitimate gripe.
Hitters smear sticky pine tar on bat handles to help their grip, which in turn helps them make better contact. Baseball rules say the tacky goop is allowed up to 18 inches from the bat handle. But umpires never really check.
I've never seen this.
I never have either.
I don't know what they're measuring.
And it turns out Brett's bat did have too much pine tar.
They might be going to call George Brett out.
Well, the Yankees win. He's out.
Yes, sir.
Brett is out. Look at this. Brett is out.
And he's steaming mad.
He is out and having to be forcibly restrained from hitting plate umpire Tim McClellan.
Brett's team filed a formal complaint with the league when the dust settled. And believe me, there was actual dust. He went totally ballistic in the infield. And MLB changed its mind. The home run counted. And here's the best part of the whole saga. The guy who complained about the pine tar, Greg Nettles, had famously been suspended after using a bat stuffed with bouncy toy Super Balls a decade earlier. You might be wondering, why do players think they can get away with this stuff? Well, it's more than just baseball looking the other way. There are 34 brands of bats approved for use in major league games. They're required to be solid wood, but each looks and feels different. Plus, they're players' property, not the league's, making them harder to regulate. Batters have exploited that for years. And why not? It seems like nothing in baseball is standardized. Here's Rick Honeycutt again.
How many basketballs leave the court? How many, you know, yeah, they're bringing in different footballs and stuff, but we're going through 10, 12, 15 dozen baseballs per game. And each ball feels different. That's what people don't understand. This one has seams, this one doesn't have seams. This one feels a little bit bigger than this one.
And it's not just equipment. So much about baseball varies depending on the day, the year, the sun, the humidity. Players learn to exploit their surroundings. Like ballparks, for instance. No two have the same dimensions. And groundskeepers can change the length of the grass, or how packed or loose or wet the infield dirt is on any given day, to help a home team or hurt an opponent. the league plays a role too. Some years, it supplies balls that are deadened to tamp down on home runs. Other years, they're manufactured to fly farther. In fact, 1987, the year Maguire set the rookie home run record, was known as the year of the rabbit ball. Home runs across the league spiked by almost 20%, and most people think the balls were juiced. Before the start of the 2021 season, the league announced it would crack down on ball doctoring, but not because it suddenly cares about the rules. It just wants to generate more offense after a few seasons of way too many strikeouts. It's no wonder no one takes the rules seriously, that punishments are so rare and so light. This stuff doesn't ruin reputations. Like, consider Rick Honeycutt. He pitched for 17 years after the thumbtack incident, then served as the Dodgers' pitching coach for another 14. His guys knew about his suspension. They laughed at the story, but it was also a lesson.
Whatever you're going to try, you should at least experiment and not take it out into a major league game your first time, that's for sure.
Part of Honeycutt's job as a coach was to make sure his players understood the game's intricacies and its gray areas. He explained that some mounds feel different than others and how to pitch in a ballpark where pop flies end up on the warning track. They listened as he gave them tips about grip, about adjusting for heat and cold and altitude. And were all of those adjustments within the rules? Maybe. Maybe not.
Where is the line between, like, fudging the rules and cheating? Did you consider the thumbtack to be cheating? Do you consider steroids to be cheating?
You know, I remember in spring training, all the years, the one thing that was drilled into you was the rule number 21 or whatever it was, no betting on baseball. That was the most stringent rule there was. If you don't want any type of substance on the baseball, then you're going to have to be stringent. If you don't want any of the other activities that they know probably are going on, you've got to make the penalty more stringent, and then it'll stop it. But when you're lax on the penalty, our human nature is take things to the max.
We'll be back after the break. Let's get back to steroids. Remember Dan Nolte, one of the pitchers from the last episode? The one who used steroids for years and got in that bar fight and still reckons with his guilt. He feels it most acutely when he thinks back to the end of spring training before his big league debut, when he won a roster spot at the expense of a friend, a former roommate, a guy who'd never used anabolic steroids.
The year I made the team in 96, he was supposed to make the team.
Instead, that friend was headed back to AAA to reduce paychecks and a tenuous existence.
And he was married, he had a kid, and I was a single idiot, and he was packing his bags, and I was sitting a couple lockers to his left. And he was trying to, you know, hold his chin up and doing a good job, just being a good sport about it. And, you know, and all I could do was think that, like, this is not supposed to be him. It's supposed to be me. I'm not even supposed to be in this room. Like, I should never even have been here.
This is the moment that haunts Nolte, the moment that cements the shame and unfairness of what he did. But let's hear it now from the other guy's perspective.
When I got sent back that day, yes, I was sad. It was a tough situation. I was very upset, but I was not at all looking across the room at Dan Nolte saying, you stole my job. How dare you? None of that.
Yep, that's right. The guy whose job Nolte stole, it's Mike Trombley. The same Mike Trombley who smeared pine tar in his arm hair and dumped coffee on his pants, who was plenty comfortable exploiting baseball's gray areas to his own advantage.
Yeah, I'm not a big believer in fate. I'm not a big believer in, hey, things happen for a reason. Things just happen and we adapt. So in 1996, when I'm back to AAA, I was really at a crossroads. Now, I was married and had a kid and wondering, geez, do I need to do something else? Do I need to become a financial advisor like I am today?
Trombley stuck with baseball. And when he got to AAA, he focused on developing another pitch to add to his arsenal. Soon, he had a pretty decent split-finger fastball to go along with the curve he'd been tossing for years.
I got minor league player of the month for April, and the Twins called me up. It really kind of launched my career of what I was. I was a setup man, and I was a pretty good setup man for a few years, and it gave me that opportunity to get confidence and to do that.
Let me get this straight. One guy cheated and took a job he didn't deserve, and the guy who probably did deserve it got a chance to get even better as a result. So good that he'd go on to have a long career. Trombley played in the majors for 11 years. More than twice as long as Nolte. And of course, Nalty's brand of cheating was far more extreme than Trombley's coffee and pine tar. They're not even comparable. But both men bent baseball's rules at the very least. The only difference? Nalty knew he could get steroids, while Trombley was blissfully ignorant to how prevalent they were, how easy it would have been to buy some.
I was never thinking, hey, if I take this shot, I could throw a 92 instead of 88. First of all, I didn't know that was an option. And if it was an option, I don't know if I would have said no. I mean, to be honest with you, I don't know if I was strong enough to say no, because once you're in that washing machine, that bubble, you make some decisions that you kind of regret.
Even though Trombley never took steroids, he has no interest in the moral high ground, no righteous indignation toward his former teammate. Learning that made me reconsider Nalty's story. Because if the victim of his cheating was also cheating a little bit too, well, that makes me think that maybe the system was more culpable than any one man. Now, Trombley didn't realize the impact steroids might have had on his career and on his wallet. But many players did understand the perks of using, that it could be life-changing, and still turn down the drugs. For some people, they were just one step too far. So, doctor the ball, cork your bat. That's fine. It's clever, ingenious even. Maybe on some level, we kind of admire that. But steroid use? Well, it's rare to find someone who'll admit to admiring that. Many people consider it the crime of all crimes against sports. Players who use become pariahs. But really, what makes steroids so much worse? Is it because they change the human body? Does that make us uncomfortable? Like, it's okay to mess with equipment, but messing with your body? Does it cross an ethical line? I'm curious about that line and if it even exists. So I called Dr. Norm Faust. He's a doctor who's also studied medical ethics in sports for decades.
There's nothing immoral about getting an advantage over your opponents. That's what athletes do.
Faust doesn't think steroids alter the body significantly more than anything else athletes do to get an edge.
There's not a single athlete or human being that I know of whose life would last very long, or career, if they just were reliant on natural things. I mean, do any of us eat foods that are natural? What's the point? That it's okay to lift rocks, but it's not okay to work out on a Nautilus machine? That it's okay to drink lake water, but it's not okay to drink Gatorade because it's unnatural?
He's speaking extremely literally, but I see his point. I've written about sports long enough to know that nothing about them is natural. Resources determine success just as much as raw talent does.
That's what sports is about, is trying to gain advantages through your natural endowment, but never just your natural endowment or your God-given endowment.
Faust has been a professor at the University of Wisconsin for years, and he's seen the value of resources firsthand. So have I. When I worked at Sports Illustrated, I wrote several stories about the Badgers football team, which, like other programs in college's 1%, has facilities on par with the pros. Look at the top 25 list every year, and you'll find palatial locker rooms, state-of-the-art weights, pools with lazy rivers and waterfalls, smoothie bars, mini golf, stuff to help athletes perform better and to attract the best talent.
So when the Wisconsin football team plays Wofford College, the average weight of the interior lineman differs by 50 pounds, literally 50 pounds. That's not fair.
In 2009, Wisconsin did play Wofford. It wasn't pretty. The Badgers weren't even a great team that year, but they won, 44-14. Wofford never had a chance. And the same is true for many pro teams, with lower payroll or less history. It's impossible to sign a star without having a fat wallet or a whole lot of championship banners. At the height of the steroid era, Faust was one of the only voices claiming that steroids were acceptable, that everyone was in an unnecessary huff about the next great development in sports. In Faust's eyes, athletes have already graduated from rocks to barbells, from water to Gatorade, from junk food to health food to supplements. So why not steroids? In that context, this unnatural thing looks almost like a natural next step. And I buy it. I've spent a decade as a sports writer, and I've written so many words about the next big thing an athlete is trying to get an edge. I've covered an NBA player who thought an experimental plasma treatment would allow him to play on shredded knees, and a quarterback who got his vertebrae fused, and a college hoop star who was a raw vegan. All of that, each of those supposed edges, would have sounded crazy just a couple of decades ago.
changing the structure or function of your body is what athletes do. They lift weights, they go on special diets, they train at altitude to jack up their hemoglobins. They try to change their bodies so they can be bigger, stronger, faster.
Foss convinced me that we're all too mired in recent history, in how we think things should be done, to consider how far training has come over time, and how small of a step forward steroids might be. There is no nuance in the public discussion of steroids. Not 20 years ago, and not now. Sports leagues, the Olympics, pretty much every governing body eventually drew a line. Steroids are wrong. Doing things that change your body chemistry is taboo. But yeah, lift weights or fly to another country for an experimental procedure. Run on an anti-gravity treadmill. If you're a pitcher and hurt your elbow, of course your doctor can take a tendon from your hamstring or your big toe to repair it. How is any of that fairer or more reasonable than taking a responsible dose of testosterone? Here's Mike Trombley again.
I think Major League Baseball has to really do a good job of making the rules. Just keep it consistent throughout. And just understand you have to change. Technology changes. People change.
Maybe that's all this is. A race between attitudes, innovation, and rules that are slow to adapt. And when it comes to steroids, the science is years ahead of public sentiment. I think we're too slow to recognize when progress becomes a new reality. Too inflexible in our views about behavior if it's someone, somewhere, some amount of years ago decided was wrong. If reporting this podcast has taught me anything, it's that cheating isn't a static concept. It evolves. It's not always stark or dramatic or intentionally deceitful. It can be as simple as me deciding not to put a star next to 7 down on a crossword, pretending I didn't also catch a glimpse of the answer to 9 across when I flipped to the answer key. And it's nearly impossible to ever truly draw a fixed line between right and wrong. But as baseball's steroid problem was slowly and painfully exposed, that's what we all wanted to do. Next time on Crushed.
Most hallowed record in sports just goes down. And now all of a sudden I have the answers to how that was achieved and how that happened.
Everyone was looking for a villain when we should have been looking for the truth. Crushed is written and reported by me, Joan Neeson. Jessica Popovac is our senior producer. Our associate producer is Devin Manzi. And our production assistant is Megan Coyle. Michael Garofalo is our editor. Jane Ackerman fact-checked the series, and Tommy Bazarian from PRX Productions mixed this episode. Gautam Chopra, Amit Sankaran, and Adam Schlossman are our executive producers. Special thanks to Lisa Pollack and to composer Michael Kramer. Crushed is a production of Religion of Sports and PRX. If you like the show, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you do your listening.